Okay, well, hello, friends. It is amazing. We are collectively, as a shul, we're up to our third Masechta for this group. And I know for some of us, it's our first, God willing, to be full Masechta that we'll be studying together. And I always am just amazed and grateful for the diversity of people that we have with us in our shir. We have men, we have women. We have people with classically yeshiva-trained backgrounds. We have people who are getting their yeshiva-trained background right now. And, you know, we have people that are in Stanford. We have people that are in New York. We have people in Chicago. I see you there, Henry. And we have people who are in Florida right now, like Gloria. And you'll forgive me if I'm not noting any other exotic locations.
Gloria's home.
Oh, well, not Florida then. Nix that. And I think we have a bit of diversity of ages. I think, is the Jesse there? Is that Jesse Salver? Is that Jesse Salver in the Jesse? Or
That is Jesse Salver, yes.
Oh, well, Jesse, it's wonderful to hear you. Jesse is another person in my generation who moved to the community, very committed to Torah study, and hope you enjoy. Okay, guys, without any further ado, the reason I'm actually here in person tonight wasn't just to experiment, but I have a meeting, a ritual meeting at 7:45, literally right where we're sitting right now. I'm joined with Lloyd and Arlene here in person. So let's jump into it. That way we can maximize our time. How do we even begin an introduction to Masechta Sukkah? I think we just got to jump right in. Here we go. Susan, welcome. Sukkah shehi gavoa lamala me'esrim ama. So we're on 2A to the first power, all right? Page number one, right? That's what I love when I have to announce the page in the Chumash when we start Parshas Bereishis. I'm like, guys, it's the beginning of the book. You'll find it. So 2A to the first power, you just have to flip a few more pages. That's the introduction. I highly recommend reading, but what Lloyd has on his. So, Sukkah shika vola mala me esrim ama. Sukkah that is 20 amos tall. You know what? I'm just going to, not that I needed to demonstrate it, but I have the Os V'Hadar Masifta Gemaras, which does a really neat thing and puts pictures and diagrams in the back of their Gemaras. So if you want to get an idea how tall a 20 amos sukkah is, look at it in respect to what a two-story building looks like, and look how it exceeds a two-story building. So that's pretty tall. And we'll talk about in the Gemara, what's wrong if I want to have a super tall sukkah, right? Who cares how tall I want to make my sukkah? If I want to make it as tall as the Eiffel Tower or the Empire State Building, why should God care about that? We'll talk about that. Psula. Rabbi Yehuda Mashiv. Rabbi Yehuda is okay with that. Now, there's some other disqualifications for a sukkah, which everyone could get on board with. Usha'ina gavah asar tfachim, if it's not at least 10 tfachim tall. Something really important, by the way, we're going to be seeing in sukkah is that many of the parameters and principles that exist in the laws of Eiruvin, right? So on Shabbos, in order to carry in what we have as a carmelis, a rabbinical public domain, we need the Eiruv, right? And what makes something a reshus hayachid, right? Why am I allowed to carry around in a good shalom even if the Eiruv is down? Because there are walls here, and the walls here are at least 10 tefachim tall. So tefach is, let's say, roughly 4 inches or so. So 10 tefachim, that's about 40 inches. So by the way, this became really popular during COVID, that people were trying to maximize airflow in their sukkahs. So it utilized a number of principles. We'll talk about lovewood and other things soon. But one principle that's important to know is that the walls only have to be 10 tefachim tall. They only have to go up about 40 inches, depending how you measure it. And then the rest we'll talk about later. There's a principle called good asik mechitzta that halachically we view it as if the wall protrudes all the way up to the ceiling, even though physically it's only 10 tefachim tall. Once you hit the 10 tefach threshold, it's a kosher sukkah, but below 10 tefachim, it's not a kosher sukkah. Same principle on Shabbos, you want to cordon off an area for carrying. It needs to be at least 10 tefachim tall. And by the way, many Erevin, they'll utilize pre-existing infrastructure, like our Erev utilizes a lot of pre-existing infrastructure, fences, and of course, the telephone poles. That's deserving of its own separate shear, of course. But if there's a pre-existing fence, and a fence is likely going to be at least 10 tefachim tall, so then that's okay. By the way, one other area that this was later applied to, of course, is a mechitza in shul. The question is, what's the minimum height for a mechitza? So one might say, well, if in Shabbos and in the laws of a sukkah, 10 tefachim is the minimum for a wall, maybe for a mechitza and shul, 10 tefachim should be the minimum as well. And it would seem in a good shalom, to some extent, we do rely on that when you go into the sanctuary. Rav Soloveitchik actually said it should be 18 tefachim, but he said 10 tefachim if they're not going to put up a mechitza otherwise. So maybe that was the history behind it. So anyway, this is what we're going to see in sukkah, like in any area of halakha, is that when you know the overarching principles, these overarching principles will span across different areas of halakha that we would never have thought to connect. And that's the beauty of the halakhic system. Okay, so if a sukkah is not at least 10 tefachim tall, it's no good either. Usha'in la shalosh tefanos has to have at least three walls. Why not a fourth wall? Because on a biblical level, a Rishus HaYachid, a private domain, again, going back to Hilchos Shabbos, only needs three walls. Rabbinically, they said it needs a fourth wall to be fully enclosed. So, okay, why do I care to know that that three walls is good enough? So you know what this comes up with? I was reading during my Shabbos away. I like to bring reading material to shul that I can't read otherwise because I usually have to make sure davening runs properly. So I brought Rabbi Chaim Jachter, right? He's the guy who kind of is the Rav HaMachshir for our Erev. Rabbi Chaim Jachter, who checks our Erev, you know, once a year we bring him in. He's the one who helps us with it. He wrote an entire book on Erevin. So he has a very short chapter where he addresses a huge misnomer about islands. There is a misconception out there that an island is inherently blocked off by the water, and thus one is allowed to carry without any further action. That's erroneous, unfortunately. Where this misconception probably came from is that there's a shita that if you have three walls and then the fourth side is water, you do not need to take further action. Why? Because biblically, you only need three walls. Rabbinically, the idea of having a fourth wall was just a concern that you would easily walk out of the boundary into a public domain without even noticing. So no one's going to accidentally just walk into the water. So therefore, one can use the fourth side as water. But an entire island, you still need an Erev. So that's Shalosh Tefanos. And then finally, Ushe Chamasa Meruba Mitzilasa. And if there is more light, then there is shade being produced by the skach. In other words, you don't have enough skach, there's too much light coming through, then pisula, then it is invalid. I want you to take a look, if you can, just at the last Rashi on the Mishnah. Art Scroll hasn't yet put out a translation for Rashi, but you guys have me here, so don't worry. So if you look at the last Rashi in the Mishnah, we're going to spend some time on this, God willing, toward the end, assuming I don't go off on tangents too much, and we'll get to the end of the Gemara. This Rashi over here says as follows: what is wrong if there's too much sunlight and not enough shade? Rashi writes something very puzzling that basically, I remember when I studied this in yeshiva, you could spend a whole year on this Rashi, this one line in Rashi. Hamuat bato barov, the muat, that which is in the minority, right? This comes up again, another parallel. In kashrus, we have an idea all the time of batel barov, right? A little drop of milk falls in your chalon is still kosher. So Rashi is saying the same principle of nullification of bittel applies here. Baruch Misha Eno, it's as if there's so much light, it's as if the schach isn't even there. It's nullified by the lack of schach. And well, who cares? I still have some schach. Why is it not kosher? So this is something really important that Rashi reiterates over and over and over again. You know the word sukkah, where it gets its name from? It gets its name from the schach, the roofing that goes over it. And if you have a deficient schach, then you don't have an actual sukkah. That's the primary component of the sukkah, not the walls, but the schach. If you don't have enough schach, you don't have a sukkah definitionally. We'll come back to this Rashi, God willing, soon. But I'd be remiss if we don't actually get to the end of the Amud tonight, which is always our goal, by the way. Our goal always for those joining us is to do at least an Amud each and every night. That way we guarantee a reasonable pace. So we're done with the Mishnah. We're jumping into the Gemara, right? A few hundred years later, looking at the Amoraim who are analyzing this Mishnah. Tznan Hasam. And you know what? It wasn't just, if you guys thought that Moshe Kurtz was able to figure out this connection between Shabbos and Sukkah, it was not me. It's just that I looked forward in the Gemara and I figured out that there was a parallel. The Gemara asked the following question from the Mishnah in Erevin. The Mishnah says, Mavoi shehu gavoh me'esrim ama. Oh, I have to take out the picture book again. Okay, Rabosai, this is why we have the picture book. Does the picture book give me a picture of a, yes, it does. I'll try to put it here. So you look at the bottom row over there, okay? Hopefully, Lloyd and Arlene, you guys can see that a little bit. You guys see on the camera?
Yes.
What you're looking at basically is that on each side, there are little chatseros. All right, if anyone's writing down key terms, you want to write down these key terms. A chatser is a courtyard. Right, that's just Hebrew, a courtyard. A courtyard, you ever be like, you ever go to like the manor apartments where I live, or a bungalow colony, so you have multiple houses opening up to a commonly shared courtyard, okay? And then on top of that, these courtyards open up into a mavoi. So a mavoi, and a mavoi connects to the public thoroughfare. So in other words, you turn off the street into a mavoi, which is like this alleyway. And then from the alleyway, you can turn into different chatseros. And the halacha is that in addition to having the area surrounded by walls, you also have what is called an eruve chatseros. By the way, you know the fact that we use the term eruv is a little bit of inaccuracy. The thing that goes around our neighborhood is actually called a tsuras ha-pesach. That means it's just a door frame. So we create like an imaginary halakhic door frame all around the neighborhood, which surrounds us. But the Erev actually means Erev is like to mix together. What's being mixed together? So basically the rabbi said, in order for you to transfer from one house in a chatzer to another house, you had to have what's called an Eruve Chatzeros. I'll explain what that is in a minute. And on a broader level, if there's a Mavoi, you need what's called a Shituf Muvos. Now, what is the Shituf Muvos? What's the Eruve Chatzeros? It's a box of matzahs. That's what it is. It's a box of matzahs, which supposedly our shul has, or the Young Israel has. I hope someone has. In which each and every one of us, you might not know it, but you have a share in that matzah. That, I know that sounded like very nice and warm and inspirational, right? Each of us has a share. There's a way to go with that. Each and every one of us, there's a print. Oh, wow. There's so many concepts. I don't usually do this. I'm throwing out so many new concepts tonight. We'll reiterate them over the coming weeks. There's a principle called Zachin La'adam Shalo B'fanav, which means that if Lloyd, right, if I find this Gemara sitting around, it doesn't belong to anyone. It's Hefker, no Simanim on it. And I say, I know Lloyd would really enjoy this Gemara. And I pick up the Gemara and I say, I am being Kona. I'm acquiring this for Lloyd. Now, I didn't call up Lloyd. I didn't ask him for his consent. But it's generally regarded as a good thing to own a Gemara. So if I pick it up and I want to transfer it to you, I can do that. I could do that on your behalf without your consent. However, there's a parallel concept called Ein Chavin La'adam Shelo B'fanav, that you can't pick up something and acquire something that's to someone's detriment. My ninth grade Rebbe gave the example. He's like, if I'm walking through the street and I see a movie on the floor and I say, I'm going to pick this up for Moshe Kurtz. So then it doesn't work because it's a bad thing for him if I'm going to buy him all the shtus to watch. So that would be Ein Chavin La'adam Shelo B'fanav. Anyway, so what's happening is you may not realize it, but at some point, hopefully one of the rabbis here in the neighborhood, if not, and I should get on top of this, picked up a box of matzahs and gave it to someone who acquired it on everyone's behalf. And since each of us, right, think about stocks, right? Each of us has a share in this challah. We have partial ownership. It's as if we're all living in the same house. And therefore, it's all one unified community and domain. And therefore, we're allowed to carry from one place to another. There's a whole separate issue. It's an additional issue. What happens when there's non-Jews, like in our community, who are interspersed and they don't join in the Eruv Chatzeros or Shita Muvos because they're not commanded in the mitzvah? So you know what we did not so long after I got here? We called up the fire marshal. The fire marshal came over and we did what's called a Schiras Rishus. It's kind of a symbolic purchasing of the rights to all of the property around here. Now, the reason you go to the fire marshal, it's actually a debate who you go to. You go to the mayor, you go to the fire marshal. You basically go to someone who would have the right to enter someone's home if they need to. So, you know, maybe the police, they could get a search warrant. It's unclear who you're supposed to go to for that right. So that way, the non-Jews are also letting us unify the entire community. Okay, so point being is, that's Erech Hatir Shit Mavos. Now, you thought we're done, right? In addition to that, the rabbis were afraid that people would just willy-nilly walk from a mavoi into a public domain. One's not allowed to carry a public domain on Shabbos. So what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to put what's called either a korah. So we're going to go back to our photos over here. Either a korah, which is a beam on top of the doorway, or I always forget which one's called the doorpost and which one's called the lintel. The lintel's the top part, right?
Right.
The top part. So either it's a beam on the lintel that makes a lintel, or it's a lechi, which is on a bar on the doorpost on the side. You may have heard the term lechi for Erevin today. It's not the same exact thing, but the thing they have in common is it's a bar. So that way, I'm like, wait, what's that weird bar doing over there? Oh, I'm not supposed to walk here. So there's a bringing it all in. Why do I give you all this information? The Gemara says there's a very similar halacha that if you want a mavoi to be kosher for you to walk in on Shabbos, the korah cannot exceed a height of 20 amos. Hey, just like a sukkah cannot exceed 20 amos. But you know what the difference is? There's a difference of language of how it describes the issue of 20 amos there. It says, San Hassan, Mavai Shehu Gavoa Me Esrim Ama Yimat. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Enotzar. So look at that language over there. It says, what do you do if the korah is too tall on the mavoi? What do you do? Just lower it down a little bit, decrease the height. Well, Maishna Gabi Sukkah, the Tani Psula, Maishna Gabi Mavoi, the Tani Takanta. You notice in our Mishnah, when it says that the sukkah is above 20 amos, it doesn't tell me how to rectify the situation. It just says, this is a pasul sukkah. Too bad. But in the case of mavoi, when it's 20 amos tall, it says, oh, don't worry, just lower it down a little bit. Why are we so, you know, ironclad when it comes to the Mishnah here in sukkah? And why are we only giving solutions when it comes to fixing a mavoi? So the Gemara offers two answers. Sukkah daraisa, Tani Psula, Mavi Durabana, Tani Tekanta. The sukkah, we're talking about a biblical level disqualification. So we say it's pasul. The mavoi is a whole rabbinical contraption altogether. So the same rabbis who said you should have a mavoi, they're telling you how to fix the mavoi and make sure it's operational according to their standards. Okay, that's one possibility for a difference in language. The Ibais Ema, an alternative answer. No, it also makes sense to use the language. In theory, we should have also given that same advice in our Mishnah to lower it down below 20 amos. Mihu suk the nepishi milsa pasukatani psula mavitelo navish mile tani tekanta. The issue is, if you look back in our Mishnah, that's not the only disqualification. There's other disqualifications. If it doesn't have three walls. If it's less than 10 tefachim tall, if it has too much sun. So you couldn't just say for all those things, if there's too much sunlight, lower it. Lower it wouldn't be the right language. So it just gave a blanket disqualification to everything. Now, why did the Mishnah just specify how to fix every possible disqualification? So if you glance at Rashi, it's somewhere in the middle over here. Dibur Hamaso Suk Denefishi Milsa. He quotes a very important Gemara in Pesachim, which people in my line of work, including myself, would do well to remember. Yishana Adam L'Tamido Derech Kitzara, that a person should teach his students in a succinct manner. So that's good muster for me. I'll keep that in mind during this year. So therefore, the mission didn't want to use different language for how to fix every single disqualification. We're all intelligent people. We could figure out, oh, if there's too much sunlight, add more stock. If there's not three walls, add a third wall. Okay, we're all intelligent people. We could figure that out. Okay, end of that section of the Gemara. The rest of the Gemara that we're going to be doing right now is going to be asking the fundamental question of, who cares if the sukkah exceeds 20 amos? What is so bad about exceeding 20 amos? Okay, let me just pause before we jump in. Any questions? I know I unloaded a lot of information a little bit uncharacteristically at the beginning. I just want to see if I could pause and clarify any concepts that we mentioned until now. Yeah, Lloyd.
If you build a sukkah greater than 20 amos, the 20 or 40 amos, aren't you getting into a problem of structural integrity?
Very good question, Lloyd. So, Lloyd, you guys hear through the microphone? Did that work? You guys hear Lloyd's question?
We heard. Yeah, good question.
Okay, good. So Lloyd asked a great question about structural integrity, which, by the way, keep that in mind, Lloyd, because you're mechaving to what Abaye is going to ask at the end of the Gemara about the nature of a sukkah. And the structural integrity piece is going to be relevant for the third answer in the Gemara. Okay, so very good point. So there's going to be three approaches given in the Gemara as to why a sukkah cannot exceed 20 amos. And each one is going to be derived from a close reading of the verses. So here we go. Number one, Mina Hanimim. Amar Rabba, Amar Krut says in the Pasuk, Laman yedu dorosechin kibasukos o shaftis bnei Yisrael, that you shall know for all your generations that I settled the Jewish people in sukkahs. So notice it says that you should know, you should be aware that you are sitting inside a sukkah. So adeser mama adam yodiashu darva sukkah. When a sukkah is less than 20 amos, I am aware of the presence of a schach hovering over my head. Once it's like three flights up all the way over there, because you're not going to see, you'd have to go all the way like this to see it. And no one's making a 90 degree angle with their body to look straight up. So you're not going to be feeling the awareness of dwelling in a sukkah. So you're not going to have the laman yedu element that's required. That's one possibility. The second possibility is given by Rabbi Zeira. Rabbi Zeira Amar Mehacha, V'sukkah t'yel t'il yoma mechorev. So notice it says, what's the purpose of a sukkah? To provide tzel. It's to provide shade from the sun. So ad esrim ama adam yoshe v'sel sukkah. When a sukkah is below 20 amos, the shade that's being provided to you is still from the schach itself. L'mala me'esher mama, but once the schach is so far up, it's 20 amos tall, adam yoshe v'sel sukkah v'sel defanos. Effectively, the schach is just so far up that you know what's really blocking the rays of the sun? Not the roof, it's the walls of the sukkah at that point that's going to be blocking it, right? However, Abaye challenges this approach. Amrle Abaye. Elemeata ha'ozesukaso ba'ashros karnayim achinami dolahavi sukkah. But if someone puts their sukkah in a valley with huge mountains, you can imagine what that looks like, but just for the fun of it, I'll show you the photo in here. Right, there you go. There's a little sukkah, and here's these huge mountains that are able to block the rays of the sukkah, okay? If you can't see it, I trust you all have the imagination to think of what two big mountains look like and a sukkah in the valley between them. So would you say a sukkah is why would a sukkah be kosher if you put it between two mountains? Aren't the rays of the sun being blocked by the mountain? So there would be a disqualified sukkah then. So what's the answer? Amarle, awesome. Dal ashros karnayim, ikatzel sukkah. Hacha. Daltafanos, Lekatzel Sukkah. Because here's the thing. In the case of a sukkah in Ashtaros Karnayim, in those mountains, if we were to dissolve the two mountains and remove them from the equation, this sukkah is inherently a sukkah that is capable of providing shade with its schach. Whereas a sukkah that's all the way 20 amos tall, inherently, it is not a valid sukkah because no matter where you place that sukkah, it's ultimately the walls that are providing it, right? Really, the walls are providing the shade, not the schach. By the way, this is an idea that you see in halacha all the time of like roi labila ein bila ma'kevispo. So I'll explain what that means. Right now, here's a good example. I was just learning this. It was either this morning or yesterday. I was reviewing some Hilchos Nida. So the law is when a woman goes to mikvah, a theory this would apply to a man going to mikvah during biblical times. So the halakha is you cannot have a chatzitza, okay? You shouldn't have anything interposing between you and the water, right? So that's why you take off your ring. That's why you make sure that, you know, you're all clean from anything that was on you beforehand. But you know what? The question is, why are people busy flossing their teeth? The water is not supposed to go in your mouth. So the idea is that it has to be ra'oi. It has to be that had the water entered in your mouth, it would be able to even go in between your teeth. So, see, the halakha recommends that we keep good oral hygiene, apparently. So this idea is that something just has to be intrinsically capable of doing something. That's what we see sometimes in halakha, similarly over here. Final approach, approach number three of Rava. Lloyd, I think you'll enjoy this one. We're going to talk about the structural integrity of the sukkah. Rava Amar, mehacha, besukos teshvu shivas yamim. Rava emphasizes the requirement that a sukkah, how many days is a sukkah supposed to last for? 7 days. Mm-hmm. All you need is a sukkah that can last 7 days. It doesn't need to be made of concrete. It doesn't need to be made of anything, special alloys or whatever that they use these days. It just has to last 7 days. Amar Torah, what's the Torah mean to convey by saying this? Kol shivas hayamim, sayin yidiras kevavah shevet yiras aran. That this is a general fundamental principle in the holiday of Sukkot, that we're supposed to leave our established dwelling places and go out and enter into a temporary dwelling. And of course, there's all good drash for a Saturday morning or Sukkot morning sermon. We're going to talk about how we leave and we experience the vicissitudes of life. Docket that for Sukkot morning. But really, Sukkot morning is really a long service. No one should be, I probably shouldn't be giving a drasha that morning anyway. But okay. But ad esunama adamosa di rosso diras aran. So until 20 amos, one makes their sukkah aran. It's a temporary dwelling. But lemala me esunama, once you're building something that's 20 amos tall, ain adamosa di rosso diras aran el diras keva. You have to make it with the right structural integrity that it can stay up to 20 amos. To which Abaye comes in again, our friend Abaye, and he challenges this. Wait a minute. You mean to tell me that the only requirement here is the height? Well, if the whole point is that it should be a temporary dwelling place that's only meant to last for 7 days, according to you, why am I allowed to, you know, it's funny, you're allowed to build the walls out of any material that you want, right? You want to tie a bunch of animals together, whatever you want. You can make the walls as long as it has the right dimensions. You can make a sukkah, the walls can be made out of whatever you want, basically. So the question Abaye, I'll just finish up this formulation. So the question that Abaye has is, wait a minute. So why should you be allowed to make a sukkah out of iron? Because iron is keva, iron is strong, iron can last a lot more than 7 days. So I don't understand what you are saying, he asks. To Rava. So Amarle, Rava responds, Haki Kamina Lach, let me explain to you what I meant. Let me rephrase this. Ad chav ama de admosa diraso diras arai, ki avile diras keva, nami nafik. Because it's all about the dimensions. When you make something that's under 20 amos, that's categorically a temporary structure. And if you choose to design it in a sturdier way, that's your prerogative. But this dimension is categorically a temporary kind of dimension we're talking about. But lemala mechaf ama, once you're building something 20 amos tall, the other most of diras keva, kevale diras arai, nami lo nafik. So if you try making it into a temporary dwelling, that's not going to fly, right? You need the structural integrity that Lloyd pointed out. In other words, what he's saying is that categorically, something under 20 amos is arai, and something over 20 is considered keva, is permanent. And it's about the dimensions. It's about the dimensions that we're talking about here. Okay, so let me pause for a moment. we just reached the end of the oven. Actually, this doesn't usually happen, but this idea actually finishes literally on the dot right there. So we're actually going to start on the top of Bezema Base next time. But let me pause for questions, and then I want to share with you what Toso says. Yes, Lloyd.
Is there any regulations of how close or how far the circa has to be from a permanent structure?
So we're going to talk about an interesting case very soon. I think in 2 years from now, Lloyd asked. There's going to be a case in which what happens if my sukkah is directly, you know, people make their sukkahs this way, where it's on their back deck and they can go straight from their house into their sukkah. So there's a question, what if, you know, the table extends from my sukkah into my house? And what if I'm partially sitting, you know, part of my body's in the sukkah, part of my body's down? So I noticed that this sounds like really like humorous and like who would ever think of such a question? But the Gemara, I believe in 2 shiurim from now, we're going to address that very question. So Lloyd, you're mechaving to a lot of things tonight. Very good. Okay. I want to share with you a few ideas. I had a lot of fun buying some new Sfarim for this year. I figured this is for the long run, so I should invest and have some good resources. So over here, I was in the Z Berman in the Five Towns, giving a shout out to Toby, who I think is actually in the Five Towns right now. She regrets that she can't be here. And I picked up the Minchas Shlomo, or Shlomo Zalman Orbach, on the Masechta. And he has a few ideas that are worthy of our attention. Number one, look back at the Rashi we started from the beginning. Remember that Rashi, the last Rashi in the Mishnah, that really wild Rashi. I don't know if we appreciate how wild this Rashi is. Rashi says, "Ushechamasa meruba mitzilasa." What's the issue if there's more light than there is shade? Well, Rashi says, because it's as if the gap in the schach overwhelms the presence of the schach and makes it as if the schach doesn't even exist, which doesn't exactly work so well. The Ran raises the following question. I'll just read from here, but the Ran is it's in the back of my Gemara as well. The Ran says, it doesn't make sense that the schach would be nullified by the lack thereof. Because we have a halakha, we'll get to later in the Masechta. What if you have 50-50, 50% schach, 50% gap? That's still going to be an invalid sukkah. But why? There's no batel barov. It's 50-50. You can't nullify the schach to the non-schach. It's because that's not what it's about. It's about when you look at the shade that is being provided. You see, if it's 50-50 on top, the light tends to branch out. So if you have 50% on top of schach, 50% of gap, you're going to have more light on the floor of the sukkah than you're going to have shade on the floor of the sukkah. So there's different ways. There's a lot of different ways of tackling this Rashi about Rove and Rubo Kakulo and so many ideas that, again, is like a whole semester's worth of study. I'm telling you, this whole Rashi, I don't remember how long we spent on it. Everything that emerges from this one line in Rashi, it's amazing. We're not going to do that. Don't worry. Another idea that I want to share with you from him is about the shiurim. You know, we explained the rationales for why a sukkah can't be more than 20 amos tall, right? Either do a shalta be'ena, you're not going to see it, or we said also leman. Well, that was leman yedu. We said it's not providing shade; it's the walls, or it has to be a diras arai. We give a number of reasons, but still, like, where did we come up with the idea that 20 amos is the cutoff point? Who came up with that? So Shlomo Zalman Orbach says, nearly, all of these quantities and measurements are actually categorically legislated from the Torah itself. And he says, Mikol Makom, Masran HaKasuv HaChamim Likvoa HaShir HaNirlem. Very important concept. It comes up in other areas of halakha. Something might be biblical, but God hands over the right to define where to draw the line and the precise parameters to the rabbis to decide. And I'll give you another example of where this comes up. In Hilchos Chol HaMoed, There's a whole debate about the origin of the laws of Chol HaMoed. Is it biblical? Is it rabbinical? So what I think, if I'm not mistaken, the standard approach, the normative approach is that many of these the prohibition of Malacha Chol HaMoed is actually biblical in origin. But wait, then where did we get all these different kind of parameters and laws and how to apply it? So then God granted the sages the right to determine where to draw the line, which measurement. So the measurements carry the force of biblical weight, but they were determined by the sages themselves. I guess quick shout out for like the Thursday. So a lot of you guys are Thursday morning book club folks. That this is reminiscent of our discussion of God giving Moshe the power to write certain psukim, the Sefer Devarim, according to his own style, and Hashem approving of it. Right. So if you get it, you get it. It's almost a similar kind of idea. Just Rosh Hashanah Orbach wouldn't go so far as to say that's how the Torah was written.
I have a question.
Yes, Zaidi.
I've heard of people having a room in their house with a movable roof, movable ceiling, and they put skak over it. And I'm wondering, is that valid?
Okay. So it under certain conditions. But this Tosos actually, to a certain degree, is going to address a similar kind of case. So let's hold that for one moment. Let's take a look at Tosos, and Tosos is going to refer to a case similar to that. Okay, so I don't think Art Scroll came out with it yet, but Art Scroll, the same way they translated the Gemaras, they've been coming out with translated Tosos. So just a reminder for our friends, you look at the right side of the commentary on this Amud, it's Rashi, and then on the left side is the Bali Tosfos. They come later than Rashi. They'll many times argue with Rashi. In this case, they're not actually arguing with Rashi, but just methodologically, Rashi's job is generally to give a localized understanding of the Gemara. Tosfos, what they generally do is they will try to put our Gemara in the broader context of Shas, and they'll ask questions like, wait, this Gemara that we just read seems to be contradicted by a Gemara later in the Masechta or in a different Masechta altogether. And that's the question we're going to ask right now. Tosos asks the following question. If you're following, it's a final Tosos. And if you skip a few lines down, last words on the line, the Im Tomar. And if you don't want to follow along in the Tosos and you want to just listen, the Yotze Shomea Ka'oner, right? If you listen, it's like you're doing it. The Kaman Deluchai Vintomer, but Kaman Deluchai Shinan, El Shatebru Uyalasosarai. Remember, all the way at the end, we just learned this at the end of the Gemara. The Sukkah just has to be Ra'oi to be Arai. As long as the Sukkah is below 20 Amos, it's categorically a temporary structure, and you can build it whatever you want. You can build it with iron, you can build it with concrete, you can build it with stone, whatever you want. As long as under 20, it's inherently categorically a Diras Arai. So wait, if a sukkah, as long as it conforms to those measurements, can be built in the sturdiest of fashions possible, this seems to be contradicted by a concept that we're told later in the Masechta. So now let me say, in Masechta's Taimus, it says, "Va'aval pisha osa sakeva in Cain amrinon." We learn only at the beginning of Masechta's Taimus, "Gishamim simen klala bechak." That rain on Sukkot is a curse, right? Because we have to leave our sukkahs because it's raining. So we're told that if it rains on Sukkot, that's God throwing the wine back in our faces, yeah? So Tosos has a great question. Question is, if that is true, but according to what we just read in the Gemara, you're allowed to make the sukkah out of whatever you want. You can take the nails, you can bang it down, you can make it out of iron, you can make it say like a house if you want. And that way the rain's not going to come in. So if that's true, that as long as I conform to the right measurements of a sukkah, I can make it out of whatever material I want, why is it such a terrible curse for rain to come down on sukkahs if I can make a sturdy sukkah that will protect me from the rain anyway? Now, Tosa says, we're going to learn later in the Masechta, that there are certain limitations rabbinically, that the rabbis came later and said that in certain measurements, you're not allowed to put boards up on your schach. It can't be too wide. Otherwise, you're going to feel like you're living in a house, and you're going to say, well, Mali, living in this sukkah, which is basically a house already, Mali, my actual house that has indoor plumbing. Not that they necessarily had that back then. So you'll then go into your actual house. But Tosa says, Mikol Makom, skipping down a few lines, came into the Osir Ella Midirabanon, Loshayach Lamemar Shagishamim, Simon Klala. So, but that's on a rabbinical level. On a biblical level, one can make a super sturdy sukkah with basically no limitation. If that's true, then what's the great curse of water coming down? Yeah, the rabbis added on some extra rules later on. Yes, of course we keep them. But inherently, the sukkah can protect me from the rain as long as I build it like that. There's no biblical limitation on that. So what's so terrible about the rain? Do we hear the question? Mm-hmm. Yeah? So Tosos answers, basically like what we kept seeing that Rashi reiterates over and over again on the Amud. Tosos says, B'yish lomar, you can make the walls as sturdy as you want. But remember what we learned all the way at the beginning? Why is a sukkah called a sukkah? Because of the schach of the sukkah. The defanos, yes, the walls do have their own parameters, but ultimately the walls are the secondary part of the structure. Mikol makom bischacha she'ikar hasukkah al shein haschach. Because a sukkah definitionally is defined by the validity of its schach, slomit kasher ad avla arayim. Even though you can make the walls out of iron if you want, the schach still needs to be, to a certain degree, a temporary structure, which would, by definition, make it vulnerable to the rain. Lloyd, yeah.
Is there any requirement that you have a certain percentage of the roof being open to the sky, because it was an old, well, I don't know, wives tale or whatever it is, that I always thought that you had to have, you know, you weren't allowed to close off the roof entirely. I mean, you had to leave certain open spaces.
We're going to talk about
inside
it.
Yeah. The sky.
Very good, Lloyd. So we're going to talk about not too far future, a principle called Dofen Akuma. What happens, you know, when you have some of the wall going over and covering some of the ceiling, and how we view it as if it's an extension of the wall. We'll get into all the minutiae. Not to worry. But there's one interesting detail that Rosh Hashanah Orach picks up on, actually the Pnei Yeshua and the Aruch HaNer pick up on, where they notice that Tosfos is not bothered by the rabbinical nature of this. You know, Tosfos is very dismissive of that it's a Dirabbanan. Tosfos says, well, it would only be an invalid sukkah on a Dirabbanan level if it's not Keva. Right? Sorry, if you establish it and you build it sturdy. But biblically, you can make it as sturdy as you want as long as it's under 20 amas. So, yes, Susan.
It's Susan. I want to get to the very basic. To me, the sukkah is supposed to represent the years in the desert and the instability of life and all of those things. And if you build it with serious walls and everything else, you've lost the whole meaning of it. The fragility of life. I mean, it's all gone. So all the rest of it, I don't even see the purpose of the argument if the purpose initially was to make us realize life is fragile. God gives us, you know, stability and strength.
Yeah.
And the rest of the argument, I don't see the point of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, these are all the details that help us reach that full understanding. But yes, certainly one of the main messages of the sukkah is the fragility of living in a Dir HaSarai, in a temporary dwelling place, 100%. Now, just while I have 1 minute left, we'll finish this up. He says, you know what? It's like Tosa says that the rabbis, you know, don't even matter so much in this case. It's considered, it's only a simen klala, it's only a curse to see rain, if on a biblical level, the sukkah wouldn't be able to withstand it. You know what this sounds like? I love the connection that he makes over here. He quotes the Sma. The Sma says that this is akin to the idea in Shemitah. You know what it says? God says in Sivesius Berchasi that if you adhere to the laws, we just had a Shemitah year, and you do not work the land of Israel during the Shemitah year, that you leave the land to rest, don't worry, I will make sure that you are supported. I will bring my blessings upon you so that you will be able to financially withstand the difficulties of taking an entire sabbatical year without working the land. But you know what the big question is? Nowadays, Shemitah is presumed to be only in force on a rabbinical level, only midrabbanan. So you know what the big question is? If a farmer in Israel says, I'm going to be a frum guy and I'm not going to work the land this year because it's Shemitah year, but does it mean that Hashem will bestow his blessings upon that farmer and give him assurances that he will not perish when he doesn't use the land? Now, thankfully, there's tzedakah organizations that help them do it. But the question is, do the rabbis, when they add things onto the Torah, when they expand the laws, do they have the power to also change the theology of what's happening? When the rabbis say it's Shemitah Midrabanan, does that mean that they could also almost like force God to bestow his blessings, even if it's only on a rabbinical level? According to Tosos, it would seem not, because Tosos says, similarly over here in Sukkah, it's only a siman klala, it's only a curse. Oh, welcome, Rabbi Cohen. It's only a curse if it's on a biblical level. So this is like a fascinating theological question about just how far the rabbis can go. Tosfos would seem to say they can expand the halacha, but they can't expand the theology. Okay. And with that, Rabosai, I am late to a ritual meeting, but it's so wonderful starting a new Masechta together. Thank you guys for coming in person. Thank you on the computer. And God willing, looking forward to being assigned this sometime in the, I guess, near or sort of whatever future. So wishing you all a Laila Tov, a good Shabbos, and hopefully see you all soon.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you.
Look at that. We got all teched out there.
There we go.
Yes.
All right. Good night.